Today's Teisho will be on a koan from the koan collection, The Transmission of the Lamp, or The Transmission of the Light. Chan Master Chu Ti of Tsinghua. A nun named Shi Ji one day came to Chu Ti's temple, carrying a basket on her head and holding a staff in her hand. She circumambulated the master thrice, saying also thrice, "If you can say something, I will take down the basket." As the master could not say anything, the nun left. The master said to her, "It is already late. Why do you not stay for the night?" The nun replied, "If you can say something, I will stay." Again, the master could not say anything. After the nun had left, the master sighed and said to himself, "Although I am a man, I am lacking in manliness. It is better to leave this temple and go elsewhere in search of enlightened masters." That night, the god of the mountain said to him, "You should not leave this place. A real flesh and blood bodhisattva is coming." Later, when Tian Lung arrived at the temple, the master received him with reverence. To teach him, Tian Lung raised a finger and the master was instantly awakened. Since then, when students came for instruction, the master only raised a finger and did not give any other instruction. There was a boy who had previously come to the master, and when some people asked him questions, the lad also raised a finger in reply. Someone said to the master, "Your boy also understands the Buddha Dharma, and in reply to visitors' questions like you, he raises one finger." One day, concealing a sharp knife in his long sleeve, the master asked the boy, "I hear you understand the Buddha Dharma, is that true?" The boy replied, "Yes, sir." The master asked him, "What is Buddha?" The boy raised a finger, which the master immediately cut off with the knife. As the lad cried out and ran, the master called to him, and the boy turned back his head. Again the master asked him, "What is Buddha?" The boy raised his hand but did not see the finger. Thereupon he was awakened. When the master was about to pass away, he said to the assembly, "The Chan of Tianlong's finger was used throughout my life." Some of you are here at the Saturday Sit for the first time, and I want to thank you very much for coming. Probably after I've read this koan, you might be nervously looking around the room to make sure everybody has his fingers. This is just a story, just a story. In the Mumonkan, in the Umenkwan, a shortened version of this story is included. And the teacher in this case, Chu Ti, is understood in Japanese tradition as Gute. So this is in Japanese translations of the Umenkwan, the Mumonkan, this is called Gute's one finger, Chu Ti's one finger. And this story is a little bit more detailed than the one in the Mumonkan. And it has some interesting details that the one in the Mumonkan doesn't have. For example, the story of Shi Ji. There was a nun named Shi Ji who was deeply awakened. Some of the texts on Zen, we encounter these deeply awakened women. Sometimes they are at the head of a temple. Sometimes they're nuns. Sometimes they're lay people, like the enlightened woman who ran the inn in the story of Diamond Shoe. So in this case, a deeply enlightened nun comes to Shirti's temple, and she challenges him to manifest his condition of mind. She does something which is a little odd. She puts a basket on her head, and she's holding a staff. She's holding a pilgrim's staff in her hand. And she circumambulated the master thrice, also saying thrice, "If you can say something, I will take down the basket." In other words, show me your awakened mind. Show me your awakened mind. And so she goes once, twice. He can't do it. He can't do it. He's the head of the temple, but he doesn't possess the insight that this nun possesses. And he's a kind person. He doesn't try to cover up. He doesn't get mad at her. He's a very kind, good-hearted person. He says, "Look, it's late, you know, you've arrived here, like, why don't you stay?" And she says, "You're a good person, you're a kind person, you know, but you don't have it yet. You're not awake." See? And then she leaves. And this is really wounding for the master. Part of what's happened to him is his masculinity has been, I mean, the koan's pretty direct about that, right? He feels his masculinity has been undermined by this event. And beyond that, that's sort of like a personal problem. But beyond that, he realizes, you know, I really don't have it yet. I really haven't wakened up yet. And I'm supposed to be the master of this temple, but what a big phony I am. And he says, you know, maybe I should just quit and go, you know, plant rice, grow rice or something. I'm such a big phony, and I really don't have it. So anyway, that night, the god of the mountain appears to him in a dream and says, "Don't leave yet. A real flesh and blood enlightened person, another one, we've just encountered one, the nun Shirchi, a real bodhisattva is coming." Later, when Tian Lung arrived at the temple, the master received him with reverence. To teach him, Tian Lung raised a finger for the and the master was instantly enlightened. So this is the first part of the koan. Beautiful story, I think, maybe a little richer than the one in the Mumonkan. You know, Zen has a particular approach to practice, which is a little bit unnerving or a little bit troubling sometimes. You know, it's possible to teach a certain kind of practice which is very different from Zen. We could have a practice where we said something like this. You always have it. You always have it. You're always within enlightenment. Always within enlightenment. And actually, that's a very beautiful way to teach. And that's an aspect of reality always, and you shouldn't forget it. You know, you're always within enlightenment. There are schools of Buddhist practice where this is the approach. You know, constantly say, you're always within a Bodhi mandala. You're always present in the Bodhi mandala. Always in perfection already. And I believe that this was sort of the approach of Huayan Buddhism in China. I actually think it was beautiful, a very effective way to teach some people. Some people. People have different temperaments. You know, I actually wonder sometimes if this isn't a very important, maybe even something that should be incorporated, a very important approach and one that should be incorporated more into Zen. You know, because people in Zen can get a little too down on themselves sometimes. They can feel, well, I'm still not awake. I've been practicing for 10 years. I've been practicing for 15 years. I still haven't had my Daikensho. I've achieved nothing. And people can get discouraged too, you know, when they come in and they sit on the cushion and they've been practicing for maybe 3, 4, or 5 years and, you know, the mind is still very distracted, very full of thoughts. And they can just say, oh, you know, I've gotten nowhere with this. I'm getting nowhere. So there's really something to this idea of teaching people by saying, you're always there. You're always there. this is really very important. And it's something, again, I'd like to say you should never forget. In a certain way, you're always there. It's always a Bodhi mandala. The truth is that we often feel depressed about our practice when we look at it with the small mind, the measuring mind, the judging mind. The small mind is the mind that looks at our practice and says, my God, I've been practicing for 5 years and I still haven't answered the mu koan. Or in my case, it was 5 years and I still haven't been taken off the breath perception koan. I was on the first koan for almost 5 years. And my little mind looked at this and kept saying, oh my God, everybody else has gone on. They're all answering their koans. They go into the Dokusan room. They come out with a smile on their face. They go to Sesshin. They come back with, telling stories of passing their koans. I'm still stuck with the breath, and I'm getting older and older, And I would get up every day and go to sit at the Zen Center in Seattle. And wake up at 4 o'clock, and my little mind kept saying, why am I doing this? I'm not getting anywhere. Now, please don't be deceived by your little mind, because a little mind never knows. Never, ever, ever. So when your small mind looks into the vastness of your big mind, all it ever sees is like darkness. It's like looking into a cave. But you have this bigger mind which is much more in contact with life. Much more in contact with life. I've told this story before, but when I was a graduate student at the University of Washington, I was so beaten down because everybody seemed to be so much smarter than I was. I would go to these classes and people would quote Heidegger in German, it's so depressing. Or, they would, Derrida, and then they would quote something in French, and they would make these, Lacan, they would say, this is like Lacan's theory of the uncanny, First of all, I didn't know what uncanny was, and then I didn't know who Lacan was, So I was constantly getting beaten up, and I would come home, and I felt like maybe I should just quit and go back to working in a restaurant, which is one of my jobs, or moving furniture, which is another of my jobs. And I actually thought maybe I'm just not cut out for graduate school. And then, one day my wife said to me, why don't we go and to the zoo? And we went to the zoo and I thought, oh, this'll never, what good is this? And I listened to some lions roaring in their cage. And it was just and the hair on my head stood up. And it was like all my cares dropped away. They just were blown away by that roar. And I just felt so purified. Now, nothing had changed in my life, but this had resonated on a deeper level. I used to get this same feeling when I would go out into the woods. I would go out up into the Cascade Mountains outside of Seattle. And no matter how bad things were, I look at the vista, those mountains are so amazing. I look at the vista and it would just, my cares would just be blown away by the wind. It was like I no longer cared about my problems. I was with the mountains, I was with the sky, And this is real. This is not an illusion. We live so much in the little mind, but really that's a very small world. When you begin to get outside of that world and you get connected to bigger mind, you see those problems for what they are, very small, very, very important in their way, but really very small. But little mind can never appreciate this. It can never appreciate this. No matter how long you practice Zen, when you look at your practice with the little mind, it always seems as though nothing has happened. And this is quite an illusion that you should beware of, because this morning people came in here and sat for an hour and a half without a break, and then another hour without a break. If you've been practicing for 3 or 4 years, you might think, so what? You know, I do this, I come in every Thursday and sit for an hour and a half. Big deal. But you don't realize how extraordinary it is to be able to do that, how deeply you have entered Big Mind, and how much you've been changed by the experience. Please don't overlook this. You know, in Zen we change little by little, sit by sit, day by day, sesshin by sesshin. And so a little mind looks and sees no change. But just remember the time when it was difficult for you to get through 20 minutes. Right? Or if this was your first time here today, if you came to the sit today, you might leave here and feel like you're going to take a long nap this afternoon. And a lot of people who come to the Saturday sit for the first time leave feeling rather exhausted. But if you keep coming, that won't be the case. You know, you'll feel tremendously energized eventually by this experience, purified and energized. And when you feel purified and energized, it's going to seem to you as though nothing has changed in your life when you look at it with your little mind. This is like an optical illusion. So people can come to sesshin and sit motionless for 8 or 10 hours a day. And what they don't understand is they're already in Big Mind. See, already in Big Mind. But they look at it with little mind and say, I didn't answer my koan, and I'm getting nowhere with my practice. So this is an optical illusion. Please be careful. So maybe it would be good in Zen from time to time if we said, hey, you always already have it. And it is true. Big Mind is always there. We just get in the way of Big Mind. You know, we get in the way. When we pay attention to Big Mind, suddenly we realize that joy, that sense of life, is always there, always there. So, you know, maybe more important part of Zen practice should be reassuring people. It's always a bodhimandala, always a place of enlightenment, always a holy. We're always at the center of the universe, so to speak. You know. But you know, that may not work very well. Always may not always work very well, and it may not work very well for some people. So, you know, that's a good approach, and you may need to hear it sometime, but it may not really put you in touch with that bigger mind. Just hearing it may reassure you, may keep you going, but it may not really open the door. See, and that's what Zen is all about, is opening the door. So Zen has kind of it takes a different approach. It's true, you're always in enlightened mind, always there. And you've got to remind yourself that when little mind is going, this is not paying off, nothing is happening, and so on and so on. But on the other hand, how to get there, how to really get there, that's another issue. When you don't feel like you're at the center of the universe, when you don't feel like you're in Big Mind, somebody telling you may not really get you there, see. You know, I just went down to Wilmington, North Carolina. I wasn't here on the Thursday night sit because I had to go down to give a talk at an English department, a humanities conference in Wilmington, North Carolina, which is right on the border with South Carolina. And you'll be interested to know it's hotter here than there. And more humid here than there, I think, too. But, you know, I came back last night at LaGuardia, and Wilmington is very beautiful. It's on the coast. You've got a lot of palm trees. You have beautiful crepe myrtles. If you're a gardener, if you're into gardening, crepe myrtles are these beautiful tropical plants. Here in New Jersey, if you plant them in your yard, they often die back in the cold of the winter. But down there in the southern climate, they can grow into trees, and they have beautiful red flowers, just astonishingly beautiful. I don't know if they have them in Taiwan and China. In fact, they probably came from China. But they're really gorgeous. And they're everywhere. And it's quite beautiful. And interestingly, when I got off the airplane, even though I was gone for just a couple days, it was funny. Things were very crowded in New York City, as always. And it was 5 o'clock, so I decided not to try to take 495 through Manhattan, wisely. I thought that was going to be a nightmare. So I just took the 279, is that right? That goes through Staten Island. It goes through Staten Island and over the Gothel's Bridge. And as I was driving through New York, everything looked so interesting to me. You know, it looked so, I thought, you know, there's a real poetry to this place. And I don't always have that feeling about New York because, you know, I'm a New Jersey person. You know, if you're from New, you know, I like to go into New York, but then at the end of the day I think, oh, brother, I'm so glad I don't live in New York. That's the difference between New Yorkers and New Jersey people, right? So I always think, God, I'm going to go back and be in the trees again, you know, see the deer. You know, I like New York, but I don't want to live there. But as I was driving through New York, you know, I thought, you know, everything looks very interesting. This city has a real mystery, a real poetry. And then, you know, as I was getting close, well, I got on the turnpike, and then I got off on Route 9, and I was coming through New Brunswick, and again, everything looked so interesting and different. You know, it was different. Even when I drove up to the campus, everything looked different. And I said, that's the strangest thing. You know, I feel like I've been gone for years, you know, really. And that's interesting, isn't it? Interesting fact, you know. You can try to enjoy things. You can get up in the morning and go, I have to smell the roses. I have to really see the trees. You know, I have to really appreciate New Jersey, you know, because it's pretty good sometimes, you know. You can try and try. You can say, I'm really there. This is a Bodhimandala too. New Jersey's a Bodhi. But you know, you go away for 2 days and you come back and everything does look better. You know, even the trashy parts have a kind of poetry. You know, it's like, you know, there's a kind of poetry, there's kind of eternal quality to these smokestacks and things. Really, you know, that's how it hit me. It was like, this is Buddha too. You know, this is like interesting to me. It's like ancient smokestacks of New Jersey. I don't think it was my imagination. It was tugging at my heartstrings, you know. And I've just gone for 2 days. But it's being gone that gave me that fresh insight, see. Being gone gave me that fresh insight. It's taking away that makes it come back to life, see. So this is like the essence of Zen. You know, the Hua Yin approach is to say, don't panic. You're always at the center. You know, you're always at the Bodhi Mandala. And in fact, this is very much the Tibetan approach too. You know, just don't worry, you're always there. You're always there. And in Hua Yin Buddhism, there were meditation practices that were really designed to look at things very carefully and so on and so on. But you know, in Zen, we say, no, let's give ourselves a little vacation first. Let's get away. And then we'll look. See, so this is what Mushin, this is what Ushin is all about. This is what Shunyata is all about. It's like, let's have a little vacation. Let's go back to the source. See, I just went to Wilmington, North Carolina, which is not the source. But when we sit on the cushion, when you go to that so-called nothing place, right, that blank emptiness, which little mind always sees as just nothing, right, you're returning to the source, So, you know, we're going to go back to the source and return to who we were before we were born and return to our original nature, our face before we were born. And stay there for a little while, and then we're going to look. And my gosh, everything is going to be wonderful. Now, you know, depending on how badly we feel, may take a little while. You may need a longer vacation, right? Depending on how badly you feel about New Jersey, may take a longer vacation. So, you know, if you have a big problem, sometimes it takes a lot of sitting. You know, real problems take a lot of sitting. When my father died, my sister was very collected and calm about it. Well, I could see my brother was really unhappy. It really cut him to the quick. Yeah, and I knew it wouldn't do any good to say, oh, it's okay. You know, it's not, you know, what could you say? You know, don't, it's all one. You know, death is part of life. You know, that's not going to make him feel any better. Right? Sometimes real tragedies require a big mind, a solution. Right? Little mind is just jabbering on. You know, little mind is of no consequence when something really terrible happens. Right? I was reading in the paper the other day that Europe is going through a record heat wave. It appears New Jersey is too. But, in France and Spain, they're having record heat wave. And it's so bad, this is like the worst drought in history in Spain. As far as historical records go back, they've never had so severe a drought. And you may have read the other day that now in Siberia, the permafrost is melting for the first time. So, you know, these are events that are important, so terrible, maybe, so frightening, so important. Little mind, what is little mind going to contribute to this? You know, very little. I mean, it can tell us, you know, the science of this and so, but a deeper response is called for, right? I mean, this could be really big problem. If you love the natural world, as I do, you know, this is like, this could be really terrible. And when really terrible things happen, you know, big mind is the only place to go. And it's really not much of a consolation to say, well, you know, when the tigers in Siberia disappear and the bears, and it's still a Bodhimandala, you know, that's not very helpful when it really hurts, you know, when it's a real tragedy, when it's a real disaster, or when you're filled with rage, right? You know, when you want to kill these people, if you want to hang the president of ExxonMobil, you know, this is a big mistake to feel that way. And when you find yourself visualizing that kind of a scenario, you know, you know you're in real trouble. You're in much more trouble than that person would be. So onto the cushion and enter deep mushin. And if you don't understand this practice, this can seem very austere and a little bit like having everything taken away from you. You know, this koan sort of playing on that, because Tian Lung comes to the monastery, right? Tian Lung comes to the monastery just in time to rescue Shu Ti. And he says, look, you know, you feel you haven't got it, but actually it's right here now, see? And that works with Shu Ti. It works, right? It works. And that's wonderful. And he holds up his finger, and Shu Ti sees the finger and realizes, yes, Buddha is right here at this moment always and has his enlightenment. It's wonderful. But does, as I say, doesn't always work. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, the title of it now escapes me. It's with Billy Crystal, where he goes out west. Somebody can speak. It's okay. What's it called? Do you know?
Billy?
City Slickers. Oh, yes. Okay, thank you. Okay, thanks. City Slickers. He's a middle-aged person. I think he works selling advertising for a radio station. And he goes to his son's school, and everybody does more interesting work than he does. One guy's dad is a fireman, and everybody's intrigued by that. And he actually lies. He says something like, I'm a spy or something, doesn't he? And then he says, no, I'm not. I sell advertising for radio. And he's so humiliated, and he thinks he's just a nobody. So he goes out west, and he goes to this dude ranch and has these adventures, and he meets this old western guy named Curly, who's like a Marlboro man, a true cowboy. He lives by the old west. He lives close to nature. And he says, you want to know my secret? And he holds up his finger, just like this monk. He says, he's got a Marlboro hanging out of his mouth, you know, and a grizzled face. He says, see, one thing. And the movie is saying, that's how you do it, right? And Billy Crystal realizes his one thing is his family. And he goes home, you know, But I think it's a beautiful movie, actually, and it's a movie that speaks to anybody who's a middle-aged male, you know. But, you know, I wonder if it worked when he gets back off the plane. You know, he still works, you know, all of those anxieties might still be there. Maybe the one thing, if he just keeps saying one thing, it'll work, you know. But I have this feeling he's going to be back in the house, and there's same stresses and strains, you know, and his teenage daughter will be yelling at his wife, and his son's grades will be going through the floor for some reason, and you know, maybe he'll lose his job, and I don't know about that one thing. You know, it's a beautiful sentiment. You know, well, that one finger, it worked for Churiti, right? And if it works for you, wonderful. You know, just sit on the cushion and say, you know, one thing, maybe it'll work. But if you've practiced Zen for a while, you know that this technique can be dangerous. It's like when we go to a sesshin, people have these wonderful experiences. So one time a person, this is actually a rather typical response. One person came into the Dokusan room and said, I feel like like electricity is just pouring through my body. This is very common. As you begin to strip away the obstacles, the body comes alive, and you feel this beautiful life energy, beautiful prana, beautiful chi flowing through your body. And this person was amazed by this and came in and said, I feel like I have this wonderful electricity flowing through my body. This is amazing. I said, fantastic, wonderful. Next day he came back and he said, where did it go? I can't get it back. And the person sits on the cushion and says, okay, electricity, come on, you know, come on. And you can visualize it, right? You can kind of remember what it felt like. So you try to remember what it felt like, yeah? But you know, the more you do that, the farther and farther you get from the world. The farther and farther you get from your body. The farther and farther you get from the energy. Because you're now forming a mental picture. And you're trying to make reality fit your mental picture, but reality has already moved on. See, this is, it's like trying to enjoy the roses. You know, if somebody's told you really need to stop and smell the roses, and then you're driving home and you see some roses and you say, okay, I'll give it a try. It's so artificial, right? So artificial. You go out and you look at the roses and say, ah, yes, they are beautiful, right? And then you smell them and think, that is beautiful. But this is all very phony. And you're actually creating a barrier. You know, one day you're coming out of work and you look up and you realize the moon is in the sky. And it's gigantic. And it just knocks your socks off. You aren't trying to have the experience. It just comes upon you with this great purity and spontaneity. See, this is, more alive, more authentic kind of experience than straining to have, we say in English, an epiphany, straining to have an ecstasy. Right? This is, it worked for Churiti, just say one thing, one finger. Right? But look at what happens to Churiti's attendant. see, in the temple there's a monk, and he sees Chirti going around saying, one thing, one thing. And the monk, we don't know what he actually experiences, but we know he's probably not deeply awake. And he's holding on to this image of perfection. He's holding on to this idea of fulfillment. See, and this is going to keep him from the gates of keep him locked outside of paradise forever. So, this seems like a really cruel thing to cut this poor kid's finger off. But it's a great kindness. Because it's saying, for heaven's sake, if you want to wake up, you'll never wake up this way. Maybe Chirti did. But you don't understand. For Chirti, that was like spontaneous experience. It was like going to the zoo and hearing the lion roar. It was like walking out of your office one day in the winter and looking up and seeing the moon in the sky. But for this little novice, it's not like that. It's a striving for perfection, striving for ecstasy, striving for Buddha. And so every time you do that, you create like a wall between yourself and the world. So out of his great kindness, Chirti says, so, tell me about your practice. Show me Buddha mind. And slices his, cuts it away. See, and this is the essence of Zen. This is what we cut. Rumi, who is not here today, was kind enough to buy in Japan a Manjushri statue for us. And in most altars, most Zen temples, there would be a statue of Manjushri on the altar. And Manjushri is like most bodhisattvas, male and female, both or neither. And she or he is holding a sword in hand. And so it's kind of a curious thing for a tradition that says nonviolence is essential, right? But on the altar there's this woman or this man, hard to tell, holding a big sword, right? In this case, it's a cute little sword. It's about an inch and a half. What is that doing on the altar, Buddhist altar? It's like there's this cut. So that's what we do. And that's how Manjushri, Wenshu became enlightened. See, cutting away illusion, cutting away mental formation again and again and again. This is what, you've all heard that quote, if you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha. This means when you form a mental image of perfection and then you try to hold on to it, you're just kidding yourself. You're straining for ecstasy, right? And that's so artificial. And it's going to plunge you into hell, actually. So cut. And this is a beautiful practice of Manjushri. It's the sword that gives life. See, that gives life, because what it cuts away is never alive. It's always dead imagination. Sandy was so kind to give me this book about this woman. I don't know how to pronounce her last name, but it's called Jane Dobish, I think is probably how it's pronounced. She's a Zen monk. Zen nun, I guess, who lives in Rhode Island. She's associated with the Soen Sanim's Sangha. And she's written a beautiful book about her retreat. She went on an extensive half-year retreat, and it's called The Wisdom of Solitude. But she has this wonderful passage from Joseph Campbell, and I marked it and the marker fell out and now I can't find it. Has that ever happened to you? So I'll summarize what it says. But it's such a, when I read it, I just thought, that's the essence, isn't it? Joseph Campbell was saying, people constantly think they need something to believe in. They need meaning. You hear that all the time. People say, what's the meaning of life? Now, I need something to believe, just give me something to hold on to. Just give me something to believe in. And Campbell says, in a very gentle way, I wonder if that's what they really want. See, because as soon as you have something to believe in, you can hold on to, it turns dead in your hands. It becomes this heavy weight you have to carry through your life. He says, is that what we really want, something to believe in, something to hold on to? Or what do we really want to have an experience, a deeper experience of being alive? It's a deeper experience of being alive. And that's exactly the essence of this koan. See, just give me something to hold on to. No, let it go. Just give me something to believe in. No. And that will be your prison. Don't believe. And what good is meaning? Meaning is what you get when you interpret a poem. So you read a beautiful poem and you say, it means this. Now, how could that possibly really help you? So what we really want is to become alive, because these ideas become like a kind of a wall around us, and they deaden us. This is why you come to Sesshin and you sit on the cushion in Mushin for a day, and suddenly it feels like the energy is flowing through your whole body, because we're stripping away all that conceptualization, all those images and ideas, and now natural life can emerge spontaneously. This is the liberating sword of Wenshu, of Manjushri, Manju. So a beautiful practice to be alive, don't you think? If somebody says, what do you believe? Just, cut. Hold up your knife, your little one-inch sword. A nun named Shur Chi came one day to Chu Ti's temple carrying a basket on her head and holding a staff in her hand. She circumambulated the master thrice, saying also thrice, if you can say one enlightened thing, I will take down the basket. As the master could not say anything, the nun left. After the nun had left, the master sighed and said to himself, I've been humiliated. I'm not really a master. That night the god of the mountain said to him, don't leave yet. A real bodhisattva is coming. Later, when Qianlong arrived at the temple, the master received him with reverence to teach him. Qianlong raised a finger and the master was instantly awakened. There was a boy who had previously come to the master, and when people asked him questions, the lad also raised a finger in reply. Someone said to the master, your boy also understands the Buddha Dharma. One day, concealing a sharp knife in his long sleeve, the master asked the boy, I hear that you understand the Buddha Dharma. Is that true? The boy replied, yes, sir. The master asked him, what is Buddha? The boy raised a finger, which the master immediately cut off with the knife. As the lad cried and ran out, the master called him, and the boy turned back his head. Again, the master asked him, what is Buddha? The boy raised his hand but did not see the finger. Thereupon, he came awake. When the master was about to pass away, he said to his assembly, the charm of Qianlong's finger was used throughout my life. So, what's the finger? Is it the finger, or is it the finger that's cut away? This is the essence of this koan. Maybe we can work on it together, but show me Qianlong's finger, please. Is it the one you see, the one you cut away? Please show me Qianlong's finger.